Big Billy got picked on at school for things he couldn't change. He tried his best to play it cool, but in the seventh grade, you either fit right in or you don't fit. That's just the cold hard truth. I wish that I'd have been the friend that Billy never knew. I think it's time to come together, you and I can make a change. Maybe we can make a difference, make the world a better place. Look around and love somebody, we've been hateful long enough. Let the good Lord reunite us to this country that we love's undivided.
Yep.
Welcome back. Top of the second hour of today's Road Warrior radio broadcast is Tuesday, July 25th, 2023. And as I said in the first hour of today's broadcast, we were sort of further exploring the subject matter continuing from last Thursday, July 20th, Friday the 21st, and yesterday, Monday the 24th, particularly concerning the notion that in the absence of a solid foundation, I would say the rock solid foundation, you will eventually fall prey to the most persuasive, influential messages, motives, and agendas. Or as the cliche goes, if you don't stand for something, you will fall for anything. And this comes in a variety of forms. One of the most influential, as I mentioned at the outset of the first hour, is the conflicting information or conflicting studies, for example. And we played for the second day in a row Bobby Kennedy Jr. and his sort of unpacking the broader vaccine concerns, particularly centering around this turn of phrase that vaccines are unavoidably unsafe. And if you do a search for the words unavoidably unsafe, vaccines unavoidably unsafe, you will be surprised to see that even Google has to acknowledge the reality of this history that Bobby Kennedy is talking about in that video. Usually we don't get the background that he gives, which gives tremendous context to the discussion. Usually that's redacted. Facts are cherry-picked. And it seems that history is sterilized and that there was no motivation. It's the accidental version of history. You can see very clearly with what Bobby Kennedy Jr. is saying that that's not the case. I think that's why most young people who go through school and learn anything of history find it very boring, because it's sterilized and the facts are cherry-picked in such a way as to give some erroneous indication that history is accidental and that there are no conspiracies, and certainly there aren't powerful, influential people who have agendas that are advanced, in some cases with force in a variety of means. That just is stripped out of the general reading of history. And it's interesting that the further you go back, you know, you bump into the Rees Committee, for example, talking about education being prepared in advance to endorse a bloodless constitutional revolution at the turn of the 20th century, and that there are groups, you know, the Rockefeller Foundation, seeking out the most notable authors of history at the of the day and saying, you know, basically, will you rewrite history for us? We want to write a revisionist version of history, essentially. And many of those folks saying, no, we won't do that, at that time. So then they went and they created their own stable of historians. And now today you come forward and you look at all of these books that come out, you know, our 100 most influential documents or whatever. And you look at the background of these folks, they're all Council on Foreign Relations, senior fellows or things like that. Which means that there is a singularity of influence, opinion, and agenda in anything that they write, because it gets approved through those channels. And that's a one-sided view. But it's presented as factual and objective and not biased, which couldn't be further from the case. And so all of this really is to kind of focus on the horrifying reality that we don't know. Most of us don't know what we believe or why in America. And that, I think, is there's a sort of scientific recipe that is being used and followed along the lines of what Bertrand Russell wrote in The Impact of Science on Society. The populace will not be allowed to know how its convictions were generated. This is one of the effects he writes about in Chapter 2, General Effects of Scientific Technique in a Scientific Dictatorship. This is what he surmises. And in America today, how many people are acquainted with the facts that Bobby Kennedy Jr. lays out in the clip that we played in the first hour today, and we also played the same clip in yesterday's broadcast, Monday, the 24th. How many people are familiar with that background? Most people are not. And then, as I said, you know, if you do a search, when I mentioned that in the first hour of today's broadcast, you do a search for vaccines are unavoidably unsafe, even on Google, you will get hits. Even Google cannot suppress the reality of this discussion. But you also find Chris Mueller's USA Today article published on July 14th of this year. No, the Supreme Court didn't declare vaccines unavoidably unsafe. This is a, as I said in the first hour, this is a classic sort of textbook straw man argument. So people will read this, and again, back to Bertrand Russell, the populace will not be allowed to know how its convictions were generated. They will read this straw man article, and USA Today is bigger than Bobby Kennedy Jr., therefore this must be true. And at the very least, I'm not an expert. I don't have time to dig into the details. So the bigger institution must be more credible. And so in the face of controversy, I'm going to side with the bigger institution as the more credible. This is something that most people do without even realizing it, but it's something that the Bernaysian types prey upon, essentially. And you know, the sort of operative concept here is Salvatore Natoli's famous quote that we in these kinds of matters, you know, we typically equate size with the way that he put it in our society, we unconsciously equate size with importance or authority, I would say. And so that's what happens in the face of controversy. As I said, you know, somebody hears Bobby Kennedy Jr., for example, laying out the background of vaccines as being unavoidably unsafe, and then you read Chris Mueller's USA Today article, False Claims SCOTUS called vaccines unavoidably unsafe, fact check. You read the fact check, which is a straw man argument. Don't dive down the rabbit hole. And mentally think, well, USA Today is bigger than Bobby Kennedy Jr., and so, again, Salvatore Natoli, in our society, we unconsciously equate size with importance and even power, and I would say authority. And that, therefore, your mind just sort of goes that way in Bernaysian sort of fashion without even realizing it. And this is one of the examples of the weaponization of our own minds and our own proclivities against ourselves and one another. All of this really has, as I mentioned earlier in the first hour, as the backdrop, Hayek's Road to Serfdom, published back in 1945, Chapter 10, Why the Worst Get on Top. It's not so much how as it is why. And I think that's a very important distinction. It includes how, I think, but certainly how the psychological forces conspire or are engineered to allow the worst to get on top. But why? Why the worst get on top? And so he writes, there are three main reasons why such a numerous and strong group with fairly homogeneous views, the tyrant's majority, is not likely to be formed by the best, but rather the worst elements of any society. By our standards, the principles on which such a group would be selected will be almost entirely negative. So, just maybe for a moment, we'll talk about this. I think I want to return to Federalist 28, maybe give you a little bit more. I have been saying that I've been sort of threatening to do this in my own mind a little bit. I think it would be interesting to unpack kind of a then and now, looking at the Federalist, looking at America today through the eyes of the Federalist Papers, I think would be a very sobering experiment. But from Hayek's Road to Serfdom, Chapter 10, Why the Worst Get on Top, the three main reasons, what are they? As he points out, number one, the group with fairly homogeneous views is probably going to be formed by, you have to reach down into the lowest common denominator, which unites the largest number of people. And he says, if a numerous group is needed strong enough to impose their views on the values of life, on all the rest, it will never be those with highly differentiated and developed tastes. It will be those who form the mass in the derogatory sense of the term, the least original and independent, who will be able to put the weight of their numbers behind their particular ideals. Lowest common denominator, the mass in the derogatory sense of the term. Second, similar to what Bertrand Russell writes in The Impact of Science on Society, the skillful demagogue, as Hayek puts it, will obtain the support of all the docile and gullible who have no strong convictions of their own but are prepared to accept a ready-made system of values if it is only drummed into their ears sufficiently loudly and frequently. This happens over the course of a lifetime, sometimes years, decades. And we've seen it, how things transition over time, over generations. And the truth is sought to be gaslighted out of existence. We see that transition occurring now. If you're old enough to remember the green energy nonsense of the 70s and into the 80s, and you know the things that Gorbachev was saying, and the generation at the time that said, this is utter nonsense, we're not doing it. You skip forward to now, how many folks remember that? And it's the same agenda, the same initiative is has been repackaged, is being reissued, and being advanced with even more concerted fervor than ever before. The people behind these things do not take no for an answer. And they're not accustomed to being told no. I think of that old, it was a 1998 article about Bill Gates and talking about him as a young person. And the article indicating very clearly that he was not accustomed to being told no. And I think that we can see that these days. I mean, read Paul Allen's book, for Pete's sake. You'll get the same impression. The third negative principle of selection for this skillful demagogue who's trying to weld together a closely coherent, homogenous body of supporters is uniting people on a common enemy, some negative, a negative program. And we have to, you know, we have to galvanize the ire or the hatred of these people along the lines of this common threat or this common enemy. We can see this in a variety of ways. The climate agenda, you know, again, if you read the Club of Rome's working paper, The Limits to Growth, which became the book in 1991 by the same authors, The First Global Revolution, you realize they say the same thing. We need to unite people around a common enemy, and this time what we're going to do is we're going to say man is the common enemy to the planet. Man is his own worst enemy. And so we have to unite man along the lines of getting rid of man. You know, speaking of that guy who isn't used to hearing no, he gave a TED Talk titled Innovating to Zero. And in the equation that he offered where we reduce carbon emissions, P, which represents people, was the first number he said that has to, among the numbers that have to get pretty close to zero. One of these numbers has to get pretty close to zero. And if you realize how the equation works, you realize that all of the subsequent numbers or factors in the equation are based on the first. And if he's saying one of these numbers has to get pretty close to zero, what would be the most effective way to get all of the numbers pretty close to zero? So man has been united in common cause against the common enemy, which is himself in that sense. We saw the episodes of mass formation that worked similarly. Matthias de Smet told us about that going through COVID, the COVID shenanigans. And it is a form of mass hypnosis. So we have evidence of these three main reasons Hayek offers why the worst get on top, fully in full effect, fully at work, and being engineered, I would say. Here in America, what does this mean, and what perhaps is the antidote? Stick around, we'll be right back after this short break.
Einstein once said, "Future medicine will be the medicine of frequencies." What did he know? Imagine you hear ocean waves caressing a beach, or a favorite song from the past. or the trickle of the babbling brook. All of these are sound frequencies that positively affect us. Terahertz is a soothing, healing frequency that has been proven to resonate at the same frequency as healthy cells. It penetrates the body and stimulates new healthy cell growth. Want to diminish muscle aches, joint pains, and experience a greater sense of well-being? Tired of spending money on short-term remedies that never seem to work? Soothing, healing, relaxing terahertz frequency is now available and as handy as flipping a switch. Terahertz technology is changing the course of what we were taught about how to maintain our health and well-being. To read more about this amazing breakthrough and to order your terahertz frequency wand, go to naturalearthmedicine.com. That's naturalearthmedicine.com.
I'm so excited to have you as part of the Wild Pastures family, and we look forward to bringing you the pasture-raised meats that you and your family will love. Now, we started Wild Pastures because so many of my clients would tell me they just couldn't find high-quality pasture-raised meats, and even when they did, it was so expensive that they couldn't afford to eat it regularly. Now, I'm not talking about the bottom-of-the-barrel healthy meats that have claims like natural or free-range or even cage-free, terms that were actually created by the industrial food industry to make us feel all warm and fuzzy about buying their low quality products. I'm talking about truly nourishing pasture-raised meats, the kind that you'll never really find in a grocery store. Our farmers are doing things beyond organic. Our beef is 100% grass-fed and grass-finished and raised on pastures free from chemicals and other pesticides. Our chickens are 100% pasture-raised, where they get their natural diet of grass and forage and insects. We will never settle for free-range, which is actually one of the most deceptive terms in the chicken industry. In fact, less than 0.1% of the chicken consumed in the United States is truly pasture-raised in the way that ours is. And our pork is 100% pasture-raised as well. So if you care about where your food comes from, then you have definitely made it to the right place. As a Wild Pastures member, you'll be supporting the most highly principled farmers in America and getting the most nutrient-dense, nourishing, and sustainable meats in the world. But I'm confident you'll love being part of our mission at Wild Pastures, and you will really love the delicious, nourishing meats that we're going to deliver straight to your door.
Visit republicbroadcasting.org and click the Wild Pastures banner ad. Secure a shipment today. Beef, poultry, and pork raised the way nature intended.
Back. So what is perhaps the antidote? Let me offer some thoughts and then maybe an excerpt from Federalist 28, and we'll go to the phones. What is perhaps the antidote to this lowest common denominator, folks who have no strong convictions of their own, and uniting people around the common cause of fighting a common enemy or some negative program? I think maybe just as a basic pretext, we could say that, you know, to borrow from G.I. Joe, you know, the old cartoon G.I. Joe, knowing is half the battle. So if we're aware of this, I'm being facetious, but, you know, knowing is half the battle. So if we're aware of this, maybe that's helpful. If we're aware that if by whatever means this happens, these forces coalesce, this recipe comes into existence, if this is the pie we're baking in America, we have, you know, there's an appeal to the lowest common denominator, that is celebrated, which makes me think of, you know, things like the quote that I've mentioned from what's his name? The Carl Sagan's book, The Demon Haunted World, Science is a Candle in the Dark, that this, you know, back in 1996, he wrote, this is the world we seem to be heading into. There is this celebration of ignorance, credulous programming. You go back further than that, obviously Knute Menow said in the early 60s that television is a vast wasteland. All the more so with social media and, you know, the technology related to that, 144 characters and things like that. What can you possibly express in that many characters? So there is that. Folks who don't know what they believe and uniting folks around a common enemy, what is perhaps the antidote? Well, being aware of this, I think, is the first line of defense. Perhaps returning to the idea that Hayek mentioned as the old, you know, kind of the old freedom. In chapter one, The Abandoned Road, that idea that Hayek offers, the essential features of that individualism, which from the elements provided by Christianity and the philosophy of classical antiquity was first fully developed during the Renaissance and has since grown and spread into what we know as Western civilization, are the respect for the individual man qua man, that is, recognition of his own views and tastes as supreme in his own sphere, however narrowly that may be circumscribed, and the belief that it is desirable that men should develop their own individual gifts and bents. But Chris, you have said that you believe that individualism and collectivism are two sides of the same coin that sort of lead one down this, you know, road to perdition under the banner of ye shall be as gods in one way or another. Whether I, you know, take personal command of that, or whether I sort of relegate and abdicate the command of that to the collective. And I do believe that, but I would maybe change what Hayek writes a little bit to acknowledge the Western esoteric impulse that I think is alluded to here but not mentioned specifically, and say that we should encourage each other to pursue our relationship with our Creator to whatever extent we, you know, to develop that relationship. And it is desirable to do that. It's interesting, you know, if you start moving that direction and you start really trying to pin down what you believe and why, and then you start, you know, maybe we ask the question, instead of uniting around some negative, some skillful demagogue, as Friedman puts it, wants to unite us around in common cause around some negative principle or program. Maybe we ask, okay, but what is the good thing that you're going to, what is the solution to this? And even if it's a prepackaged, you know, problem, reaction, solution, opportunities of crisis sort of scenario, I think even that will be made at least somewhat self-evident if we just ask the question. And the Angus Bergen moral imagining a new moral economy comes to mind. Stick around.
You are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
This is Elizabeth McCabe, a.k.a. Lucky One of Truth Frequency News. I wanted to tell you all about Extendivite from HeartDrop.com. Y'all know I check everything before I air it. When I heard about Extendivite on TFR, I went to HeartDrop.com and started my research. It's got cayenne. That's good for blood and circulation. It stimulates the blood flow. It's got garlic, which fights bacteria like antibiotics, and it lowers the cholesterol and blood pressure. It also has milk thistle, which is the best detox for liver. I couldn't wait to try it out, and I'm glad I did 4 months ago. And here's obvious results. My hands and feet don't get cold anymore. The varicose veins have faded too. My wrists don't hurt after typing all day. Now, I tell you all this because it's true and I want you to really live life. Try Extendivite. Go to heartdrop.com and order it.
Extendivite is only $69.95 for a 2 month supply of either capsules or liquid. Call now. That's 1-877-928-8822 or visit heartdrop.com.
Extend your life with Extendivite.
My name is John. I'm the founder of Blackout Coffee, and I started Blackout because I really love coffee. I've always loved coffee, and after traveling so much to Europe, South America, and trying so many different coffees that were so good, and every time I came back to the U.S., I was so disappointed with the coffee, so I figured that I had to do something about it. The biggest difference is on the beans and the roasting process, how we roast it, and how fresh it is. The fresher the roast, the better the quality. Here I have like all of the coffee. It's roasted within 1 to 2 days prior to being shipped. So it literally gets to consumers' house within 3 to 5 days after being roasted. If you like coffee, you have to try ours. It's fresh roasted. It's one of the best beans that we can get, and you will definitely see the difference.
Visit blackoutcoffee.com and use the coupon code REPUB10. That's REPUB10.
Hello, hello, hello from beautiful Colorado. My name is Samuel Jung Kay, and I am currently the lead Shilajit hunter and master herbalist for Colorado Shilajit Company. In this video series, I will be discussing what we believe is the greatest of all adaptogenic superfoods and the single greatest natural healing remedy gifted to us by Mother Earth. I think you too will become as excited by this incredible substance called Shilajit as we were and are after our discovery of this amazing gift right here in beautiful, colorful Colorado. You may already know Shilajit by other names. Shilajit, Momio, Momi, Mami, Mineral Pitch, Asphaltum, and others. Shilajit literally translates to destroyer of weakness and conqueror of mountains. Shilajit has been in use for thousands of years and is considered as the highest valued cure-all of any earthly substance.
Look for the gold mountain and medical symbol logo in banners on republicbroadcasting.org to watch the full video and see more information. Use code GORBN when ordering. That's G-O-R-B-N.
Reluctantly crouched at the starting line, engines pumping and thumping in time. The green light flashes, the flags go up. Churning and burning, they yearn for the cup. They deftly maneuver and muscle for rank. Fuel burning fast on an empty tank. Reckless and wild, they pour through the turns. Their prowess is potent and secretly stern. As they speed through the finish, the flags go down. The fans get up and they get out of town. The arena is empty except for one man, still driving and striving as fast as he can. The sun has gone down and the moon has come up. And long ago somebody left with the cup. But he's driving and striving and hugging the turns and thinking of someone for whom he still burns. He's going the distance. He's going for speed. She's all alone. All alone in a time of need. Because he's racing and pacing and plotting the course. He's fighting and fighting and riding on his horse. He's going the distance.
Welcome back. So speaking of the opportunities of crisis and how this all works, you know, since we get away from a solid foundation of right and wrong, didactic thinking, and then we are shifted into this dialectic vortex, the dialectic Nicky Rapana used to remind us about, we get led by degrees down this road to perdition. We don't realize that there is an agenda here that people plan for opportunities of crisis moments, like Rahm Emanuel said, you know, to do things you think you could not do before. And Angus Bergen unpacked that for us in that clip that we play from time to time as we went through COVID. He literally spilled the beans and sort of spelled it out in the panel discussion that they had titled Imagining a New Moral Economy over at Johns Hopkins SNF Agora Institute back in April of 2020. This was right when the COVID stuff was really, you know, kicking into high gear. And this is what Angus Bergen told us. Go ahead, please.
Choices made in different places. So Angus, maybe this is a great way to bring you into the conversation. Because, you know, you've written in some ways like a really important book about sort of thinking about these questions of political economy in a historical sense. And so can you, historically speaking, give us a sense of what are the conditions under which economic crises or other kind of societal crises like the ones that we're in right now lead to a reimagining of a different kind of socioeconomic structure?
Yeah, well, one point I'd like to emphasize is that it's a bit of a misnomer to think that crises lead to a reimagining. A lot of the work to do the reimagining needs to happen before a crisis takes place, right? And so if you look at any of these moments, whether the 1930s, the 1970s, where we can think of sort of epochal shifts in the way that people address issues of political economy, a lot of the underlying work for that transformation happened within theoretical communities, often decades before a crisis came to pass where they came to light and were enacted into policy. And so, you know, I take that as one of the central missions of the work that Margaret has been doing and the work that Anne-Marie is doing is trying to take the ideas that are out there, bring them together, get people speaking to each other, and then make them accessible to policymakers so that when a crisis like the one we're in right now emerges, it becomes newly possible for people not to have to reinvent the wheel, but rather just reach for ideas that are available on the shelf to experiment with possible solutions.
Great.
Isn't that something? Reach for something off the shelf and experiment with possible solutions. Now, a question should arise here. What the heck is a moral economy? Because that's the title of the video or the title of the panel discussion, Imagining a New Moral Economy. And by the way, in the description reads the politics and policy of COVID-19, : Imagining a New Moral Economy. So the politics and policy of COVID-19, Imagining a New Moral Economy. Right at the outset of COVID, April 3rd, 2020, they're having this panel discussion, and this is no accident. They're reaching to the shelf to experiment with possible solutions. Margaret Levy, who is one of the panelists, had done a TED Talk back in 2018 titled A Call for a Moral Economy. And the description reads, work and purpose in a future of robots. In the face of AI and automation, how can we ensure work lives of meaning and purpose? Director, Center for Advanced Study in the Behavioral Sciences, CASBS at Stanford University. This talk was given at TEDx event using the TED conference format, but independently organized by local community. So it's Margaret, who's also a panelist, giving this talk. What is a moral economy, though? There are more examples, but there is a background that was shaping up, and basically there is sort of a preparation for the opportunity of crisis, which was COVID in this case. But what is a moral economy? And in simple terms, it's the ESG movement. What do you know about that? We have this, all of this machinery coming online just in time. It's just another one of these just-in-time scenarios. A moral economy, according to Wikipedia, refers to economic activities viewed through a moral, not just a material lens. The definition of moral economy is constantly revisited depending on its usage in different social, economic, ecological, and geographic situations and times. The concept was developed in 1971 by the British Marxist social historian and political activist E.P. Thompson in his essay, The Moral Economy of the English Crowd in the 18th Century, to describe and analyze a specific class struggle in a specific era from the perspective of the poorest citizens, the crowd. So do you see how this is a weaponization of what I'm talking about? Uniting those folks, the common denominator, the crowd in the pejorative sense that Milton Friedman, or excuse me, that Hayek is talking about in The Road to Serfdom, Chapter 10, Why the Worst Get on Top, the weaponizing of that group, the mass in the pejorative sense, that have no strong convictions of their own, don't know how their opinions were generated, and they're being united along the common line of the hatred of a common enemy, which is actually themselves. It's the classic Marxist tactic of weaponizing the people against themselves and one another. And so if we are truly Americans, we should be opposed to Marxism. We should be suspicious of the British influence, and we should be particularly suspicious of British Marxists. But we've lost our way. We don't understand that there were a group of folks back in the 1880s, called themselves Fabians, who wanted to essentially reinvigorate the British Empire. And you know what? Maybe we don't need bayonets in every house. Maybe we could do it ideologically. Maybe we could just influence and persuade people to be good British subjects in an effort to really go back to the old Roman Empire and really back to Genesis chapter 11, so we can finally finish the great unfinished work. That's what this all represents. And speaking of the Fabians, what did they say? They wanted to create a feudalist society. So with that in mind, let me just offer this and we'll go to the phones. From Federalist 28. If the representatives of the people betray their constituents, this Federalist 28, which I mentioned earlier by Hamilton, the working title is A National Army and Internal Security. But you get a picture of what the feudalist world looked like before and how it was prone to the throes of conflict, perpetual conflict. If the representatives of the people betray their constituents, there is then no resource left but in the exertion of that original right of self-defense which is paramount to all positive forms of government, and which against the usurpations of the national rulers may be exerted with infinitely better prospect of success than against those of the rulers of an individual state. In a single state, if the persons entrusted with supreme power become usurpers, the different parcels, subdivisions, or districts of which it consists, having no distinct government in each, can take no regular measures for defense. The citizens must rush tumultuously to arms without concert, without system, without resource, except in their courage and despair. The usurpers, clothed with the forms of legal authority, can too often crush the opposition in embryo. The smaller the extent of the territory, the more difficult will it be for the people to form a regular or systematic plan of opposition, or the more easy will it be to defeat their early efforts. Intelligence can be more speedily obtained of their preparations and movements, and the military force in the possession of the usurpers can be more rapidly directed against the part where the opposition has begun. In this situation, there must be a peculiar coincidence of circumstances to ensure success to the popular resistance. The obstacles to usurpation and the facilities of resistance increase with the increased extent of the state, provided the citizens understand their rights and are disposed to defend them. The natural strength of the people in a large community, in proportion to the artificial strength of the government, is greater than in a small, and of course more competent to a struggle with the attempts of the government to establish a tyranny. But in a confederacy, the people, without exaggeration, may be said to be entirely the masters of their own fate. Power being almost always the rival of power, the general government will at times stand ready to check the usurpations of the state governments, and these will have the same disposition toward the general government. The people, by throwing themselves into either scale, will infallibly make it preponderate. If their rights are invaded by either, they can make use of the other as the instrument of redress. How wise will it be in them, by cherishing the union, to preserve to themselves an advantage which can never be too highly prized? It may safely be received as an axiom in our political system that the state governments will, in all possible contingencies, afford complete security against invasions of the public liberty by the national authority. Let me back up and read that one more time. It may safely be received as an axiom in our political system that the state governments will, in all possible contingencies, afford complete security against invasions of the public liberty by the national authority. Projects of usurpation cannot be masked under pretenses so likely to escape the penetration of select bodies of men as of the people at large. The legislatures will have better means of information. They can discover the danger at a distance, and possessing all the organs of civil power and the confidence of the people, they can at once adopt a regular plan of opposition in which they can combine all the resources of the community. They can readily communicate with each other in the different states and unite their common forces for the protection of their common liberty. And there's more, but I'll leave it at that. And there are obviously nuances to this discussion in the modern age of information and information warfare and psychological operations. But hopefully you get the point that this is a different perspective than the one that we are fed these days. That we are just feckless, gelded, inert little children who need to rely on the technocratic experts for our every need, essentially. I think that's enough. Let's go to the phones and grab Pat in Texas. Pat, thanks for calling. Welcome. We have Pat. Are you there, Pat? Shall we move on? We don't have Pat. Do we? Okay. So let's go to Tom in Utah.
Hi, Chris. There's not ignorance. There's not ignorance illicit dependence. In other words, if I can keep you ignorant, I keep you dependent.
I would say so. Yeah, absolutely.
I got three nouns to throw at you. Eucharist, habeas corpus, vaccines. What do those three words have in common? What is their etiology or etymology? What language are they in the first place? Are they English? Or a dead language?
Well, I mean, if you're referring to Latin, I would
exactly.
say, you know, we've been encouraged to believe that it's a dead language, but it's not.
Which professions would use it as their means of maintaining your ignorance?
Well, we've played Neil Postman's remarks along those lines about how, you know, I wish I could remember how he put that. I think he really sort of unpacked that as well as anyone. That we invent lexicons to, you know, for the clubs. Clubs create their own lexicon.
Exactly. We can speak to each other but keep you ignorant if you're just an observer or...
Yep.
Exactly.
Not in the club.
You see, that's one of the reasons why I became disenchanted with medicine, is because we were using language that nobody would understand. So they would look to us in the white smocks as the officials or the authorities. Mm-hmm. The same thing in law. You look to the black smock. Same thing in the Eucharist or in the Vatican. You look for somebody who's going to tell you what you're supposed to know. Mm-hmm. They won't tell you the truth. And the word vaccine is a dead giveaway, if you understand Latin.
Unintended, vaca perhaps.
Vaccine.
Yeah.
Vaccine. What does that mean? Blood of the beast. I think there's a scripture in the Old Testament that says to avoid the blood, right? Yet we go to a white smock to be injected directly, bypassing the firewall of our liver, our protections that our body naturally has. We go directly into the artery, or into the blood vessel, and inject the blood of the beast and wonder why our body turns against itself. Because we've just injected the same materials we're constructed of. But we overdosed. See, all vaccines, one item that nobody ever discusses is the slaughterhouse waste that is cultured to produce that vaccine. So what are you doing? You're putting in the tissues of your own body back into your body, but it's not your body, it's a foreign body. See, when I worked in transplant surgery, three phenomena we had to deal with: rejection, DNA corruption, and memory corruption. Isn't that bizarre?
Mm-hmm.
The blood of the beast goes through the entire creature, so it gets the sloughing tissues of all tissues, including the glands. And when you inject that stuff into your body directly, your body is like the Creator says, thou shalt have no other gods before me. What does your body say? Thou shalt have no other bodies before me. And the most violent reaction that a body can elicit is against a tissue that's like itself, but not itself.
Yeah, it is
the
alchemical remaking of mankind.
Exactly.
Into a kind of a homunculus, you might say.
So the greatest offense you can commit against your body is to put something in your body that is like your body, but not it. Anyway, that's all I wanted to contribute, is the fact that they utilize the language of Latin to deceive us in the three professions.
Yeah, absolutely. We should dig up the Neil Postman clip that I'm thinking of and maybe play that. We got other calls we got to grab. Thank you, Tom. Much appreciated, as always. That's a great point. Back to the phones, Larkin, Texas. Thanks for calling. Welcome.
Well, hi, Chris. I did want to touch upon Brandeis, but I think we'd all do well to recognize that what we call economic science used to be called moral philosophy. We can go back to Adam Smith, you know, the theory of moral sentiments. We can look again at contract theory, you know, the contributions of John Locke, Thomas Hobbes, and Jean-Jacques Rousseau, of course. But, you can bet that any solution that is being proffered from eggheads at any level today, because of the nature of what's happened in our universities and our public-private school institutions, all solutions proffered are going to be communitarian solutions. And the idea of throwing something against the wall to see if it sticks, of course, goes right to game theory and how this new technology has enabled these asswipes, excuse my French, to be able to inflict unconscionable harm to people, and in their minds, all they're doing is just testing the waters to see what sticks, if you will. And so I'm going to revisit Angus Bergen again for your show today. But let's remember that these so-called economists, what they are is they're all socialists. Okay, every one of them.
Yeah, and Marxist. And, you know, to your point about game theory, to understand it, I mean, I think most people need to understand it's you know, many things. But simply put, you know, this is the ultimate strategy of advancing an agenda where basically, if you understand game theory properly and you put these things into that lens, then basically no matter what you're doing, it's not just the test, measure, and repeat kind of thing. It's you're advancing your agenda with every iteration, if that makes sense. That sounds kind of vague, but we're running out of time. So,
yeah, Louis Brandeis probably did more harm to America in the 20th century than just about anybody I can think of.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm thinking about his Aswander rules. I mean, this guy was put in on the bench under the Wilson administration in 1916. He was actually an advisor to the so-called creature from Jekyll Island that created the Fed. He was there during the bankruptcy. This guy knew all along who had the monopoly control over the issuance of currency and credit. Okay,
yeah,
and everything about him was knowing what was up in terms of his tribe and who was in charge and who was in control. And so he could inflict his view of the law in the Western legal tradition as largely Talmudic, as informed by the Zohar. And that's why I say this creep should not be lionized by anybody.
Absolutely. And for an interesting view, folks can read Alison Weir's book, Against Our Better Judgment, The Hidden History of How the U.S. Was Used to Create Israel. And she includes, you know, she's written, I think, fairly comprehensively about the influence of the intriguer, Louis Brandeis. And it's a history that even people who know Brandeis, I don't think, know that history. So,
yeah, well, it's pretty sad what we're witnessing today. And of course, all we can do is just speak against it and, you know, try to articulate what we're seeing as well as we can. And hopefully numbers will make a difference, but I don't see it.
Yeah. Yeah. I can't disagree with that. Thank you. Thank you, Lark.
Thank you. Thank you, Chris. Bye-bye.
Much appreciated. If you're interested in what I just mentioned in conjunction with what Lark was saying about Louis Brandeis, there's a video, Alison Weir discusses explosive info on the Israel lobby and Louis Brandeis regarding Bruce Allen Murphy's book, The Brandeis-Frankfurter Connection, the Secret Political Activities of Two Supreme Court Justices. Interesting history. That'll do for today's broadcast. I hope it was informative, perhaps even edifying. As always, it truly is an honor and a pleasure. Take care. God bless. We'll catch you on the other side.
Here's some interesting news. Due to all the recent claims about possible nuclear wars, viruses, solar flares, and civil unrest, people are scrambling to prepare and stockpile food. But the one thing out of reach for many is an underground bunker. Until now. Because you can now have a 3D printed underground bunker in just one day. An excavator digs a hole in your backyard, and 3DBunkers.com shows up in a small truck and sets up their 3D printer under a tent completely undetected. They can print as many rooms as you want at a fraction of the cost compared to traditional metal bunkers. 3D Bunkers uses polymer concrete, which is 5 times stronger than regular cement. YouTube 3DBunkers.com and watch the video. The creators of 3D Bunkers is looking for a business partner that can help bring this technology to the world. And we need to protect our way of life without living in fear. Contact Brad at 3DBunkers.com for more details or visit 3DBunkers.com.
You can't handle the truth.
You're listening to Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit republicbroadcasting.org today because you can handle the truth.